Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone. Today, we have two big sci-fi anniversaries that all released on the exact same day back in 1982. The first one we're going to be talking about is The Thing. It was a commission podcast by Sean. Actually, both of these were commissioned podcasts by Sean Ray, old school Bald Move fan. Of course, The Thing directed by John Carpenter. The thing about both of these podcasts that we're re-releasing today, Jim, because they're both, these podcasts are both roughly 5 years old. We know a lot of people probably haven't known that we did these. Some of the older archive stuff is hard to access, so we like to re-release it on these anniversaries. The thing that really stuck out, and the one of the reasons I really appreciate commission podcast, is I would have never gone back and probably watched The Thing otherwise. Like, wow. Why would I watch a 40-year-old horror movie? You know, it's like, its hallmark was practical effects, which in my mind is shitty rubber stop motion animation, Harryhausen skeletons, and this Voyages of Sinbad and whatnot. Like, and I would have never thought that something that old could both scare me and provoke some genuine thought, you know.
Makes sense.
Boy, I was wrong.
Yeah. I had seen this movie before, right? So I knew the reputation, and that kind of blows my mind to hear you say, like, yeah, why would I go back and watch this stupid old thing when I know this is one of, like, the high watermarks of technology when it comes to physical effects.
Right. Right. But you could say the thing about King Kong. Like, that was landmark animation for its day. And if you go back and watch the 1933 King Kong, it's kind of a big piece of shit. Like, I mean, it's like we can quibble over, you know, putting yourself in. But I mean, it looks like a stop motion monkey and a stop motion dinosaur and they're slamming together in some claymation studio. This thing holds up. Like, I think that, like you said, this is the pinnacle of practical effects. Like, you can tell some of it is fake, but it looks convincing. And some of the stuff is just amazing.
Oh, yeah.
So this also led me to become more of a John. Well, no, actually made me become a John Carpenter fan, because I went out and checked out things like the original Halloween, The Escape from New York and L.A., some other things that he's kind of justifiably famous for. And coming to a new appreciation of the man. He does his own thing, and he's got a way with a soundtrack too.
Yep, sure does.
Other thing I was not prepared for, and I think I even missed it, because if I recall correctly, you called it out to me, and I've seen this movie 3 or 4 times since, because I watched it. Cecily had never seen it, so we watched it together. Then we watched the American sequel that has to do with I think it's the Norwegian base that the dog runs from in the beginning of the movie, which is not bad. And then I watched it again to compare. The hat, the fucking hat that Kurt Russell wears in this movie.
Yeah.
What the fuck, man? It's a good thing he's got a nice ass, because that that hat really takes away from the other part of the package.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have anything to say for the 40th anniversary of The Thing before we let 5 year in the past Aaron and Jim take it away?
I mean, I'd say a lot of stuff about it in the actual podcast, which we're about to get to. But this is one of my favorite horror movies of all time. I'm a big sucker for things like The Fly and this, which have those practical effects that really just are disgusting. The Cronenberg-esque body horror stuff is fantastic. So I guess enjoy the podcast.
Yeah, enjoy these two. Both debuted back in June of 1982. And here's the first one, The Thing.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers have a chance to exercise their rights under the Patreon pact we've made by voting for the next pulp movie that Jim and I will be covering. If you're one of the elite few backers at the executive producer level, don't miss your chance to influence us. Hurry over to patreon.com/baldmove and vote in the latest movie poll before it closes on Wednesday morning.
And for all other club members, we've got an all-new episode of Lunch with Jim and Aaron this Friday afternoon. Catch the live stream at 1 p.m. to interact with us and your fellow munchers over on Patreon, or you can wait for the podcast to drop later that day.
If you want even more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
Hey, everybody. We are back with another commission podcast, this time by prolific commissioner Sean Ray, especially dominating the late commissions, the last of the classic commissions. He wanted us to watch 1982's The Thing. Science fiction horror film directed by John Carpenter, starring Kurt Russell and a ton of character actors that you will recognize, including Wilford Brimley and Keith David as Blair and Childs, respectively. This is the first time I've actually seen this movie.
Oh, man.
Which I was worried, because I know that this I've heard this is a well-regarded science fiction horror film. And I was worried that with the 1982 that it was going to be hokey and unconvincing and kind of fakey. And that wasn't an unwarranted opinion, but I found that it didn't. I had no trouble being immersed into the film and getting caught up with it and buying its premise and getting sucked into the situation, which is briefly, if you haven't seen The Thing, spoilers for a 40-year-old movie. It involves Americans at an Antarctic research base who think they become infected by some alien thing that can genetically copy them and then hide amongst them and kill them. And if it gets out, it can infect the entire world, and they're cut off by a storm and various disasters, and they have to solve this. It's like the Predator, only cold instead of hot. Spoilers for the movie throughout here. Jim, what's your opinion?
I mean, in my opinion, this is one of the all-time great horror films. And if this were just simply a vehicle, I don't know the names of the people who worked on the practical effects in this movie, but if it were simply a vehicle for their practical effects work, I think it would be good enough. The fact that it is actually a really interesting film in and of itself just puts it over the top as a true classic for me.
Yeah, I was amazed at how well this movie held up, and the fact that, you know, there are definitely, you can tell that these are practical effects, but I don't think it takes it away. It's just more of like, wow, they were able to do this. Like, I was, right. I was really concerned with how, like, man, how did they do this? Like, almost the stop motion of these tentacles whipping around, because it looked way more fluid than that. And I found out that what they did is they extended the tentacles and then retract them. And then played it in reverse. So it was all real physics whipping things around, but it just happened in reverse. And I'm like, what a clever fucking effect. Yeah. And it absolutely survived. Some of the shit, some of the mutations this thing comes from, like,
it's so fucked up.
The guys from id Software absolutely owe John Carpenter money.
Yeah.
From their demon designs and stuff. And like, this I see as being so influential for so much creature design in the last 30 years. It's fucking believable. I know Sam Winston was one of the,
I heard he worked on it, but didn't want to like steal thunder from the main guy who worked on it.
Right. I'm trying to find that information. He, like, you know, cause he helped out a little bit, scenes here and there, but he didn't want to didn't want to oversee the main special effects guy.
Yeah. But I mean, the effects are so good. I love practical effects to begin with.
Right.
Because I think they just feel like, even if they don't look perhaps as realistic as CG effects can look nowadays, they feel more realistic to me. Like, you know, that's a thing that people could look at and people could interact with on set.
Yeah.
And to me, I'm always more impressed by that. But the effects work is so damn good that I look at it and I have that question, like, how the hell did they do this?
Mm-hmm.
How the hell did they get this alien to halfway integrate with this human body and flail around the room for a good minute and a half without having actual human beings hurt during the process?
Like, yeah.
I honestly couldn't tell you how they pulled off the effects they did, some of the best effects.
Some of the stunts look borderline unsafe. Like, some of that shit with the flamethrowers, and like, wow, how in the world did they do that? But, like, there's a lot of times where they just set a stunt guy on fire. And, like, it's insane. I just looked up, it's Rob Botten.
Okay.
Who Rob is this? Bodden, or maybe it's Botten. It's the special effects and makeup supervisor and designer. So
I mean, surely they had to win some kind of effects award for this movie, because it's so night and day, like, above anything else I've seen.
So here's the thing about the thing, which I found shocking. This was not highly thought of or regarded, and was not exactly a box office bomb, but was seen as a disappointment that set John Carpenter's career back probably a decade.
Yeah, that's shocking, because I think it's a really sound, it's a really well-constructed film.
It's the rare film where almost everyone has come around. Like, 10, 15 years after it debuted, people are like, you know, the thing is actually pretty incredible. And I was amazed at, like, how well it held up from just a filmmaking perspective. Like, it looks great. The character designs, like, Kurt Russell's costuming, how he changes from, like, essentially a bush helicopter pilot to an action hero. He's got, like, dynamite strapped to his chest, and he's he just looks bat, and, like, with his, like, ice climbing pickaxe. It's very like, just as iconic as Ash from the Evil Dead.
Sure. Yeah.
But, like, it never feels like, you know, he's putting on some kind of ridiculous costume. It's just like, oh, these are the things he's done. You know, like, I kind of want, like, a McFarlane figure of MacReady with pickaxe in one hand and flamethrower in the other.
That'd be,
like,
sweet.
That would be really cool to have on your mantle, right?
And I think that's the number one thing that I like about this movie, is that every plot development feels like a natural next move. You know, it's this chess game that they're playing against this alien, which, fine, that's fucking cliched, whatever. But every decision they make, every test they decide would probably work, is going to work, right? Yeah. It works. Nobody comes up with a stupid idea that obviously wouldn't work, and they spend 10 minutes on it and it doesn't work. Everything they think of, these are very smart people, they're scientists in a research station.
Right.
Everything they think of works, and it's just a matter of this psychological game between the thing and the humans. And it just feels so natural. Like, the plot progresses so naturally.
Right.
I never step back and go, oh, this is a movie and they're just trying to get me from this point to this point.
And the setting's cool, because it's, like, as close as you can get to, like, an alien world by and still be here on Earth, because they're isolated. Yeah. There's no immediate rescue on hand. The environment itself will kill you if you don't have, like, support and shelter. You know, it's these Antarctic research bases are famous for being, like, these psychological pressure cookers.
Yeah.
Like, because, like, in the winter, you are left alone for 6 days in utter darkness. You don't get to see the sun for 6 months. And it's so cold, like, the average daytime temperature is negative 60.
Yeah.
And the night it gets to negative 80 to 90. That's average. And it's just unrelenting cold. You can't, and like, that's the situation you throw this insanely paranoid situation onto.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just great. It's great.
The movie does not play with cheap tricks. That's the number one thing I like. You know, the ideas are hit upon. The logic of them is sound. They work. It's just this battle.
Yeah, and it's like, there's no jump scares. It's just like, behold the horror of what's going on. Behold this creature transforming and what it's going to do. And
I kept finding myself out loud saying, oh my fucking God, this is This is vulgar. This is obscene, and it's horrifying. And what's again, happening.
I fully recognized it was fake. But it's still just the. It's kind of like reading a book lets your imagination go wild. Just the implication of what's going on to these people and what they're being transformed into, and like the horror of being like. I kept on thinking like they repeat the scenario over and over again, like being a dog in a kennel that's locked in with this thing, or being a man that is handcuffed to this thing, and the only way to kill it's a flamethrower.
Right.
Like there's just a lot of just like Jesus Christ, this is. Fucking crazy. Like to see someone torn apart in front of your eyes and you're handcuffed to this thing, and the guy with the flamethrower, number one, having trouble with it. Number two, I'm handcuffed to this thing that's gonna get flamethrowered.
Yeah. It's fucked up.
Yeah.
And that all being kind of a microcosm of the larger thing, which is twofold. You know, they're stuck in this research station with it. Mm-hmm. They can't go anywhere. Mm-hmm. And also we're stuck on this planet with it, right? And if it gets out, it has like I think Sean says it was 3 years is the calculation before all of humanity is taken over by this thing.
Right.
So yeah, it's very much a like you're trapped in here with it kind of thing.
All right, before we get too much further, I want to get Sean Ray's comments, and he's got then as is wont, he's got a trivia section and some final thoughts for us, some final questions.
Okay.
Sean says John Carpenter is one of my favorite directors because his films are always fun. None of his films would be AFI top 100 material, but every time one of his films begin and I hear one of his soundtracks kick in, a huge grin forms upon my face. Mm-hmm. Like I gotta say, I don't think much of the original Halloween, but fucking killer soundtrack.
I mean, it's
the Michael Myers theme is just
as iconic as Star Wars. Yes. As iconic as Indiana Jones.
Yes. Yeah. It's amazing. I love the aspect of fate or chance in his movies. The thing lands on Earth during the last ice age in Antarctica, a place where nothing lives. It's frightening to think if it landed anywhere else on our planet, every living creature would already have been the thing. This movie and my previous commission, Blade Runner, opened the exact same day in 1982. Both were box office bombs.
But dude. Yeah, we'll talk about this. Keep going, but very quickly, we need to come back to this idea of opening on the same day.
But both would later become huge cult classics. The atmosphere and attention to the film are great, even after watching the film God knows how many times, at least 30. I still don't know exactly who or when any one character is the thing. These characters probably know each other so well because they've been locked up together for God knows how long, but now they can't trust each other. The paranoia introduced in this film is extremely well done.
Yeah, I mean, that is the movie to me. Like, this psychological... Who is the creature? Who is the thing? Who isn't the thing? How do we tell?
Yeah, this is a social deduction game where the penalty is gruesome death.
Yeah.
And that's...
And potentially the entire planet being subsumed by it.
Yeah, and that's the other thing is, like, you can see some men, like, really balk at the... Like, in the last act of the movie, about half of the men are on board with the idea that we're going to die killing this thing, and half of them are not.
Yeah.
And that even so that even when you think you're on the same team, you've still got that. And yeah, like I wish I knew a little bit about what exactly infected you, like just merely touching the blood or does it have to bite you? Because but having those rules be unknown and how the hell would these guys like you can't conduct double blind tests like there. It feels very early goings of a zombie apocalypse where like you're not sure if it's a scratch or a bite or, you know what, like. Not knowing the rules kind of makes it even scarier.
It does, yeah. You could also say that that's maybe like the confusion, the not knowing who is the thing when could be a negative against this movie, but I guess I don't view it that way. I view it more from the horror aspect of it.
I feel like you could... That's only a criticism if you feel like the creator is using it to jerk you around.
Yeah.
And I never thought, like, there wasn't some third act, like, oh, we know its weakness is sonic waves, so if we rig up our station's radio, it'll fuck it up. Like, there was never... Yeah. Like, just because the rules were poorly defined, it wasn't used of, like, haha, deus ex machina. It's just like, well, it's an alien thing, and you're cut off from... You've got 1.5 scientists, 1.5 doctors, and... That's it.
Uh-huh.
That's what you've got to solve this problem. A radio operator, and, you know, it's real good. And the fact that these guys are all like world class character actors.
Yeah,
like, I've seen every single one of them except for maybe Windows and a lot of other different stuff. And they're all like, you know, I think that's one of the charms of Kurt Russell, and he's, you know, we'll talk about his place in the badass pantheon, but he's kind of a Bruce, a little bit, he's a Bruce Willis type in that he is an everyman.
Yeah.
So, you know, when he kind of takes it upon himself to take over the station and start giving orders, he's not like the natural, I don't think he doesn't come across as the natural leader. In fact, maybe he's not even the most well-liked person. Mm-hmm. He's the type of dude that will ruin a computer because a chess computer program beats him.
Right.
Like, dude, how many of these Apple IIs do we got in this fucking research station just because the computer beats you? You're going to, the hell's wrong with you, man?
Yeah, it was, I thought that was pretty hilarious, actually.
Yeah.
In that, boy, that was uncalled for kind of way.
Also, one of the, like, that's the only woman character in the entire movie is that chess computer's voice.
And he kills it.
And he kills it, and it's John Carpenter's wife. There's all kinds
of
layers of that onion you could peel back.
I do like, though, talking about how muddy the plot could get. Mm-hmm. A couple of times they ground it, you know, they bring it back in. So you've got this idea of the thing taking over everybody, and they don't know who it is, and then at some point they do the test, and they put down all of the things that they know about, right? Mm-hmm. All of the things within the research station itself, and so there's only one possibility left. Mm-hmm. And that one possibility is that it's the doctor,
right?
And he's cordoned off into the shack, so you know, okay, it's become much simpler now, right? We just have to hunt down this one thing. The objective is very clear again. And I feel like without that, it could have easily spiraled out of control with the guessing game.
Right.
I thought that was really smart.
And it kind of does, because at the end, like, they set up an engineered situation where the thing could still be alive.
Well, that's fine at the end.
Yeah.
I think you want that question at the end. That's the thing that kind of makes the ending of the movie for me. You didn't want that the entire time, right?
Apparently, they forced a happy ending on it, and it didn't. They forced two different types of happy endings where it was made clear that Kurt Russell survived and he wasn't infected, and they didn't test well, so they let John Carpenter have it his way, and he did the, you know, very ambiguous, dark, fatalistic, nihilistic ending.
Uh-huh.
All those things.
Yeah, I like it.
I guess I kind of wish, well, I mean, that's why Kurt, because the only way it would have been more satisfying for me is if Kurt Russell had killed himself and Keith David.
Because I feel like that's the natural outcome there, right?
That's what you have. Only if you really believe this is an existential threat to humanity, then you almost have to.
There's the argument that he simply became tired of fighting at that point.
Right. But still.
And well, I mean, everyone has a limit. Yeah, everyone's got their limits. There's only a certain point you can push people to before they will just throw their hat in. And let me talk about that hat that Kurt Russell would be throwing in.
Mm-hmm.
What the fuck is that? What the fuck is this gigantic, cumbersome cowboy thing that he's wearing on his head?
I mean, he goes kind of like more hoodie later on.
I mean, he could wear it as a hoodie, yeah. the hat. Surely you noticed the hat.
No, I really didn't.
Holy,
I don't know what hat you're talking about.
The hat is so big.
What hat?
His cowboy hat.
He has a cowboy hat.
Oh my
is he
God.
Only wearing
Are
like
you
the
fucking
no seriously
with me?
No, because when I think when I close my eyes and see him, I see him like my
with the hair. Yeah, with the big
no,
flowing.
Like my the iconic look for him is like with his like you know he's got the parka on with his hoodie pulled tight and it's just like in his face peeking out. And with his goggles, like
maybe you mistook his enormous hat for a hood.
Was that no? He's wearing a hoodie throughout the movie, a gray hoodie pulled over his head. I'm not fucking with you.
Maybe during the storm scenes, but he starts out in a cowboy hat, and it's kind of the iconic look of Kurt Russell's character in this.
Yeah, he's also got kind of the feathered hair of like Ashton Kutcher from the '70s show.
Yeah.
So I don't remember the cowboy hat.
Wow, that's shocking.
This is the only first time I've seen it, though.
Yeah.
And I was looking at, because that's the thing, is like, I didn't know what to expect. Actually, I didn't know what to expect. I know that this is renowned for being, I knew it's practical effects, and I've been around the internet long enough that I've seen in isolation, like, still pictures of some of these creatures. And I knew it was like a very psychological kind of like pressure cooker situation, but I was very shocked that the first scene was essentially a flying saucer.
I actually didn't remember that either. Yeah.
Wow. They're just laying. I thought that this was like they, you know, and I kind of wonder if that wasn't a mistake. Like,
maybe
that definitely said that it was an alien thing. I guess that they later dig up the saucer.
But you might have left that for then, right? You might leave that for the middle of the movie discovery.
Yeah.
I love these kind of movies. These are right up my alley. The Alien, the Event Horizon, you know, the movies where they go in and they say, what the fuck is happening here?
Yeah.
They go into a situation that is unknown. And they have to figure it out. Those are some of my favorite movies.
And this does it so well
because it starts off with this helicopter chasing a dog in the middle of the Arctic.
I was
shooting at a dog. Why the fuck are you doing this?
And then terribly too, might I add.
Right.
I mean, I get it's a moving shooting. Target. It's a moving, but you got a scope and a semi-automatic sniper rifle. Yeah. Like, get the job done.
They're
man.
Research scientists. You know, they're not marksmen.
Yeah.
But it builds this very like. What is going on here?
It really does.
That is right up my alley.
Yeah, because I'm like, why are they hunting a wolf? And then like, why the fuck this wolf in particular? And then it turns out it's a dog. And, you know, I thought that was it's funny because this is a repeating thing, right? The Norwegians fought their battle at the base, and I guess there's a prequel in 2011 that was essentially telling the Norwegian side of it. Have you seen that one?
I have. People hated that.
Really?
I haven't seen it.
Because I saw some of the creature effect works just isolated on YouTube, and it looked fucking amazing.
Huh.
So, like, I kind of want to see that, and, like, it's essentially the prequel. It ends where this movie begins.
Okay.
But I thought there was a nice symmetry from, like, the last few Norwegians mishandling the explosive that killed them all, like, with the end of this movie, where there was a similar kind of, like, mishandling of explosives, and, like, suddenly Kurt Russell's got to find the thing and fling it. He was slightly more successful than Norwegian.
Yeah.
But I did like the symmetry of, like, the horror of realizing that, my God, look at this base. Look at this ruined Norwegian base.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this is going to play out on the American side, too.
So much so that, in fact, they shot the Norwegian base after they had shot everything on the American base.
Right.
And they used the same set.
Right, right.
The destroyed set as the Norwegian base.
It saved like $250,000 to do that,
too. I mean, it's a really good idea.
Smart.
Because you don't know until the end of the movie that's true.
Yeah, like a Russian ice base, Norwegian ice base. I mean, they're all going to be geodesic domes and bivouacs and...
Right.
You know, I actually did this. This inspired me to do some more research on the current technology in the Antarctic bases. And... Mm-hmm. The main one, I forget what it's called. The, you know, starts with an R and first name R, last name M. Menudo. It's the Ralph Menudo base at the Antarctica. That they've rebuilt that so many times because essentially 3 feet of snow accumulate every single year, and this old base is just eventually get buried.
What the fuck?
That this new one is designed with aerodynamic principles to like. Use a scouring effect. So like it's first of all, it's on legs, it's on stilts.
Okay.
And it funnels the snow, the wind underneath it, so it blows that snow away, and they can raise and lower the whole entire base to keep it above the snow level because they got tired of like rebuilding it every 15 years.
Go under the snow. Subterranean base.
Go sub snowarian.
Yeah.
Sure.
Sub snowarian. Yeah.
I don't know why that, I mean, surely there's a good reason for that hasn't occurred.
I mean, the hatch would probably get buried a lot.
Yeah. You'd have to, like, keep it.
But then you just have to clear the hatch. That's not so hard.
But maybe, like, once the hatch gets to be 300 feet of tunnel, like, you know, you get a bad snowstorm and then, like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
But no, it's like, it's amazing.
Or snowed in, maybe.
And still only, like, as big as the base and fancy as the base has gotten, because it's a very important site for, I guess, astronomy and all this other things. The conditions are very dry.
No light pollution
at all. Plus you get 6 months where you can do observations all the time because the sun's not in.
Right.
There's still only 50 people to live there in average winter. And they start off every, once the last transport ship leaves, they have a movie festival night where they watch the 1950s version of this movie.
Oh my God.
The Thing and the sequel to The Thing.
Why would you do that?
Because I think it takes an odd duck to do that.
For
to
sure.
volunteer. Yeah. And like, that's the kind of like, well, this is what we're in for, you know? Like, just get
that
out of your system.
That sounds like fun, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought so, too. I thought so, too.
Just shoot the dogs. If dogs come running up to your...
Yeah, shoot all
to
dogs.
To your base, just shoot the dogs. Shoot the Norwegians.
Yep.
You'll be good.
What... So...
Let me go back to the this idea of being released on the same day
as Blade Runner.
So that's kind of an amazing coincidence to me that two classic movies were launched, you know, on the same released on the same day.
Yeah.
June of 1982 was a fucking ridiculous month. I looked it up on a website.
Loaded, huh?
For release days. So the 25th, The Thing and Blade Runner both came out.
Mm-hmm.
On the 4th of June, earlier that month, Poltergeist came out.
Wow.
And Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan came out. And then on the 11th, E.T. came out.
Wow.
That is one of the most loaded classic months I can think of.
Yeah, everyone's one of somebody says we're living in a golden age of science fiction fantasy. I'm like... I don't know. Maybe we're starting to catch up, but yeah, I felt like as a kid there was a lot more science fiction fantasy than there is now. Even, I mean, you know, excepting like The Expanse and Game of Thrones, which are like the heights, the highest of the highs, but like, the, you know, maybe the average quality is going up, but I don't certainly don't think the quantity. Like, I don't feel like I'm getting enough science fiction fantasy in my life.
Yeah,
I know, I mean, you don't give a shit about fantasy, but
you know,
science
stuff
fiction.
That's going to be classics, mm-hmm. like that. And I know these weren't instant classics, but
a lot of them were, though. E.T. was
yeah.
world beater right from the beginning.
And I think Star Trek 2 certainly was the fans
commercial success. Yeah,
instantly.
Because I was just trying to think, like, when's the last time we had a movie like The Thing where it came out and it takes a decade and a half to be considered a classic? And like, I can't think of any. Like The Matrix, it'd be like almost if The Matrix, if no one watched The Matrix when it came out, and then 15 years later, people are like, you know what, this is a pretty fucking amazing film.
Yeah, the slow burn movies, I know they happen.
I mean, there's some things that I'm personally like Pontypool, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I feel like that's at best a cult classic. That's not exploded as like, oh, this is an important film that everybody should have seen.
Yeah, I'm thinking like stuff from the early 2000s that is now classic that wasn't at the time.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't think of any off the top of my
like,
head.
Especially
sure
the way this,
exist.
Where this is talked about as like, it went from, Roger Ebert gave this 2.5 stars.
Oh, God.
And said that the special effects were amazing, but the characters were flat and the situations were not plausible. Like, to go from that to like, this is widely regarded as the finest science fiction horror film of all time. That's an amazing turnaround that doesn't often happen.
Yeah, I guess I just flat out disagree with Ebert on this.
Oh, yeah.
Because I don't think the scenarios are implausible at all.
Right.
I mean, and if you grant that an alien comes down from space, then everything else follows, in my opinion.
I will say that this exposes one of Ebert's biases, where like he did seem to be pretty squeamish when it came to like hardcore violence and just gore. And like, I can only imagine what this was like watching back in the day, because like, I was repulsed and like tense when these things were happening, because the camera just like fucking lingered on this shit, and like things just kept, just when you thought things couldn't get worse, things got worse, you know?
No, and that's the thing I love too. It starts off with this horribly disfigured monster of a human being at the Norwegian base, right? That they bring back to their base.
Right.
Yeah, I feel like in most movies, that would be the climax of their gore and their horror, their body horror, right? Like The Fly.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of equivalent to what The Fly ends at.
Yeah, Jeff Goldblum steps out of the booth and it's like, Jesus fucking Christ, look at that thing.
But you get the Jesus fucking Christ at the beginning, and that's just where this movie starts.
Yes.
And then from there, it goes to places that I can't think of any other movie that goes there.
When that dude's head pulled itself off of its body, sprouted spider legs and upside down. That's what I'm saying. Like,
yeah,
like the guys that did Doom, the guys that did Half-Life, that like mouth in the middle of its chest cavity. That's like a total John Carpenter the Thing. Like, these guys all owe enormous debt to this movie, because it kind of reimagined what a movie monster could be.
It's not,
you know,
human, you know?
This wasn't like, this didn't look like, I mean, I guess Ridley Scott gets that a little bit too, like the, like, you know, the gets away from like just a guy in a suit.
Yeah,
like
an alien.
Alien could be anything.
Yeah.
Alien could be something that takes you over and rewrites your DNA. Like, and that's like even The Expanse, like talking about great stuff, it absolutely owes a huge debt to The Thing, with its protomolecule shit. So yeah, I don't know how to talk about this film in like particulars, because again, I only saw it once, and it was kind of a hell of a thing. And I spent a lot of time like researching Antarctic research stations rather than the movie itself, especially since Sean Ray's got a lot of like trivia about it already.
Yeah,
I will say that like the other thing about this film is the lighting and costuming. Like, I felt the final sequence in a generator room where everything is like bathed in this blood red light. Mm-hmm. Was such a cool like final boss level. Like, Wilford Brimley was the real final boss. He was the biggest, most monstrous thing. It was underneath the research station. Almost all the other humans were dead by this point. Like, and the other thing is like I'm a little bit encouraged because I wrote down in my notes like at the beginning of the third act, like I'm having trouble keeping track of who could and could not be the thing.
Right.
And when they became the thing. And I guess like that's a feature of the film that like it leaves a lot of things ambiguous. Like, there's a couple of scenes where, you know,
yep,
like this is what happened, but half of the infections are kind of like surprising. In fact, they said in that final like blood test scene, which I think is the best one, that's like one of the most tense, amazing things in the film.
Yeah,
they fake you out because you like, I had thought that the base commander was the alien the whole time. Uh-huh. And it turned out like, and that was one of the biggest jump scares I've ever got.
Right.
Because he's like, yeah, we'll leave you the last. And I'm like, oh, this is going to be a slow buildup of tension. Holy shit. What went on with that blood? Oh my God.
Look, now they have to fight the creature and everybody's then, and the flamethrower's
not working, right. And everyone's still tied to... Yeah, it was a fucking event, man.
Yeah, that was amazing.
I was crawling out of my skin in that scene.
Uh-huh. And then, like I said, everything narrows back in from there, right? You kind of reset the board.
Right.
And say, okay, now we know. Now we know who's who. Yeah. Let's go fight the one we know could be.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I don't know. It's great. It's great. I do think... The doctor who's out in the shack most of the thing,
Wilford Brimley,
right? Yeah, I really like how they portray this alien as, you know, mimicking human beings and kind of, you know, taking over their personality and understanding, you know, who they are.
It can make a perfect copy, which at first I thought meant physical, but like you could, like it'd be mute or something.
Yeah.
But no, it like...
It's everything. It's your knowledge. It's everything. But it also retains some of what it is, right? Because you see that Blair, and I think this is really a small point, but a really good one, is that Blair builds a spaceship, or not a spaceship, but a flying vehicle in the form that the thing understands.
Yes.
Like the saucer kind of thing that we see at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
Because Wilford Brimley, the doctor, doesn't have any knowledge of how to build
something
that would fly him out of there, right? So it falls back on the knowledge of the thing.
It's almost like the thing is its own intelligence, but it uses what it's absorbed as like meat puppets.
Yeah.
Is what I felt like.
And you can kind of see that at the end when it turns into kind of everything at once. You know, it turns into a person and a dog and part of the thing. And
yeah, that's what I kept on thinking of, like the echo, like the alpha, that was like an alpha and omega scene. Cause I wrote that in my notes, is because like, just like you had the mishandling of explosives, but you also had the fusion of the canine threat and the human, like it was all like tied together in a nice little bow in that final scene.
You know what? I think Phantoms. Have you seen the movie Phantoms with Ben Affleck? It's based on a Dean Koontz novel.
No.
It kind of owes a lot to this as well. It has some kind of amorphous, ancient alien creature that lives underground and is kind of coming up through this town. And he goes and has to deal with that.
Yeah,
and it can also take shapes.
The other thing is, like, I thought that the thing was like an explicitly Lovecraftian tale. But apparently... it's not, like, it definitely has like cosmic horror and like things beyond human understanding and like the sites, but like I thought like I in my research I would read that John Carpenter is like, I'm a big Lovecraft fan and I like this cosmic horror stuff, but apparently no, this is a, you know, based on a tale. Like I said, this is, I'm trying not to get into trivia because Sean Ray has got a bunch of it. And you've already like stepped on two of the things, so
well,
that's the commits that you pay the money for.
At risk of stepping on another, what do you think of MacReady's nuclear option here? You know, at one point he decides, look, none of us are going to make it out of here. I think it's when the generator goes down.
Mm-hmm.
He says, none of us are going to make it out of here. We need to drive this thing out and kill it with fire.
Right.
And he just sets about blowing up the entire station. I feel like they should have held that moment back just a tiny bit longer.
Hmm.
Because what they do is they go, oh shit, the generators are down.
Yeah.
We'll never survive.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what they don't know yet is that the generator is gone, right? The generator is fucking...
Mm-hmm.
There's no way of repairing it.
Right.
They could have repaired it, potentially, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know why they gave up so quickly. Oh, generator's down. It must be completely destroyed. We'll never repair it. We're all going to die. That seems like a leap. I think they could have moved that idea of, okay, we're just going to go all out trying to kill it because we're doomed, to after they discover the missing generator.
Interesting. My counterpoint on that is I had no trouble buying it, because in fact I was a little exasperated that they were still in saving our skins mode once they found out that, like, this thing is an existential threat of all humanity. Like, I'd like to think that I'm the type of person that, I mean, it'd be sad, I don't know, because I was actually thinking that, like, what would it be like to acknowledge that, well, okay, I'm giving up my hope for life, and now I'm now living for, like, humanity at large.
Uh-huh.
And my individual life doesn't matter, like the rationally grapple with that. But I just took it as a matter of granted that, like, there's no way they could repair, even if the generator could be repaired, you couldn't repair it faster than you'd freeze to death. Because again, negative, I mean, this is in the summer, so it's not quite that, but still, like, you're talking fantastically cold conditions, and you're living in these things that are surrounded by ice. Like, as soon as the power cuts out, like, I would be like, 16 to 24 hours. Can you rebuild a base generator with your current skill set? Like, I guess I just like took it at their word that, like, there's no way you could repair it. You got to kill this thing. And there's only what four of them left at that point? Three. There's two guys that went down plus Keith David. So there's four guys left at that point.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, like, at what point do you, like, because the other tension of the movie is, you know, Kurt Russell puts this out at the halfway point, is like, if things get winnowed down far enough, this thing's going to stop hiding and just go into attack mode.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, if you fart around trying to repair the generator, do you split up the party? That's the other thing I thought was a slight annoying point. When it's in, and something Echo with Roger Ebert, he said, it seems like a lot of the early goings could have been solved with an airtight buddy system, but they resort to, like, okay, rope everybody together, and we're going to figure out this test one way or another far too late. And they're way too cavalier about just going off in the base alone. And like at one point, like, I felt like Kurt Russell's MacReady character should have known better. And he's like, I'm just going to go off and get drunk in my bunk. Like, what the fuck kind of reaction to the current events is that, man?
Yeah.
But I think that's just, like, my modern... Like, in the last 30, 40 years, I think, you know, that behavior in the face of something crazy apocalyptic is less tolerated, you know?
Yeah, I guess I don't necessarily agree on the urgency of fixing the generator. I mean, I look at how much fire they could produce on that base, and I go...
A lot of fire.
They could survive for quite a while. They have a shitload of kerosene, although they tried to start the biggest fire the North's ever seen
at
one point.
South.
The South has ever seen. At one point, to burn this alien thing, they spent, I don't know, half their kerosene reserves for the entire year on that one thing.
Right.
But they had a lot of means of making fires, and I think... You know, you can keep one room of that thing, maybe the storeroom, warm for a good long time with the fuel they had.
Well, let me ask you this.
Certainly long enough to repair the generator.
Because this is a question I had that I didn't know if I just I was taking notes and I missed a line of dialogue or what, but... Why was it such a shit show?
I don't know.
Because, like, I figure maybe, and this is maybe just something they bent the rules a bit. I felt like... your communications work excellently at the South Pole.
Yeah, you'd with the shortwave optimum, radio, you're going to get...
You got optimum atmospheric conditions. Mm-hmm. You could bounce shit off the moon or whatever. Like, you'd have the power you needed and equipment. Like, the idea that they couldn't... Because there's not just one research base there.
Right.
There's, like, a dozen by a whole bunch of different countries. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'd buy that there's Norwegians that didn't speak English. Especially the last two. But, like... You'd find someone that speaks English at one of those research bases that you could get assistance at. That was the one thing that the whole time I feel like they didn't adequately explain why the radio didn't work.
And I mean, shortwave radios, you could hit Australia from Antarctica, no problem.
New Zealand, like,
no fucking problem.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they speak English there.
Yeah, yeah. South America, New Zealand, like Chile.
There must have been some kind of interference. I think they hint at stuff, but they never really say. I was a little confused by that too.
The other thing the movie I thought was shockingly bad is the matte work when they find the alien dig site. Like, that's one of the worst matte paintings and composites I've ever seen.
Okay.
Like, it wasn't nearly detailed enough to be like it. It's like, again, every other practical effect was so freaking amazing. That matte work was just terrible. Hmm. God, terrible.
Needed to call in Ralph McQuarrie.
Maybe.
Get him in there.
Because it just, like, that really took me out of the movie, and which is weird because I thought the initial saucer, an honest to God flying saucer, like a 1950s era flying saucer, I thought that was actually a pretty cool 1982 imagining of a stereotypical Hollywood flying saucer.
I have one other question for you about the ending.
Okay.
If all the thing wanted to do is freeze and wait for something to find it.
Yeah.
Couldn't it have just run away? Like, the humans can't follow it out into the tundra. So just run away.
But then it freeze. Might not be found again.
Well, so it maybe, wants maybe to stay not. But if it, can, if it can hibernate forever.
Yeah.
Eventually.
I mean, just wait till Antarctica wanders into the equator again in a couple hundred million years.
That's what I mean. Like
Pangaea 2.0, baby. It's your time to shine.
And hopefully there'll be some humans to eat. I don't know. But yeah, it seems like that would have been a solution for the thing, is to just run away from the base far enough. You know, after destroying the generator and killing essentially everyone on slow-mo, just run out into the cold.
I mean, that's what is trying to do is the dog, right? I mean, it was just trying to escape because they were like in hunting it down and killing it mode.
Right.
That's a good point. I mean, I guess like if I wanted to give the movie charity, which I kind of do, is that the thing knows that it's like if it can hide out on this human base, that more humans will come. Yeah. Whereas if it goes out into the tundra, like who the hell knows? Like is it aware of how many hundreds of thousands of years it was asleep?
It's a good question.
Because I don't even know they didn't establish like when it landed.
They don't. No. And they asked the question, like, how long must this thing have been out there?
And they said like this sheets of ice were like thousands of years. Like, so it's ambiguous, but so, like, and maybe it's doing the math and like, well, I could just never be found. I can never fulfill my primary purpose. I don't know what kind of intelligence it has. Like it can build a starship.
Yeah.
Out of a generator part. So, like, it's super smart.
And its society can apparently build starships, you know, on their own, because that's what it came
but
in.
But it's almost like programmed like a scout, like in very much the protomolecule, out of the vein of the protomolecule in The Expanse. Like, it's a vanguard that's like, or those engineers from Alien. It's some kind of vanguard that's to spread its genetic diversity and kind of like terraform a planet in advance of some other invasion, I guess.
Yeah, it's kind of like Starship Troopers sort of thing.
Yeah.
Like they hurl rocks at you with the seeds inside, essentially.
Right, right, right. Yeah. Or, yeah, there's the...
I think that was what Starship Troopers
were doing. Yeah. I mean, that's a rich vein to mine in science fiction. The whole, invasion of the body snatchers type of thing. Mm-hmm. What else you got to talk about? Because there's still quite a bit of Sean Ray material.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
Let's go to his stuff so I don't step all over it.
Okay. I watched the commentary track with Carpenter and Russell once, which I highly recommend for any film they do together. They brought up a good point of, if the thing is a perfect imitation and all it wants to do is survive, would it even know if it is the thing or would it believe it is the human it was imitating? For example, does Palmer know the entire blood test it's going to be discovered as a thing, or does it only realize once the group does?
I mean, I think the thing has its own consciousness as well,
and its own objective.
It's integrated too. Like, it's weird to say, you know, it's a perfect copy. I think whatever it becomes when it takes over some kind of being, like a dog or a human, it becomes a separate thing which is able to perfectly imitate a human
as a way of cloaking,
but isn't physically exactly that human. I think, right. Like, because you look at the end, right, where it turns into this hybrid of like dog and human and thing, and I think all of those things are a part of it,
right?
But it's able to manifest like a convincing, perfect imitation of a human.
Yeah. I feel like that's its like the Predator's cloaking device, and it only sheds it when it absolutely has to.
Yeah.
Like, it's about to experience direct harm, or, you know, or it's got a one-on-one situation where it can feed. So like, I think it's, and the other thing is like, you know, Wilford Brimley's character was building a spaceship when he wasn't being directly observed. So that tells me like, it knows. It's not like, it wasn't sitting out there shack thinking, oh, I'm Wilford Brimley, I got the diabetes. Right. I got to watch that. Like, it's using it as a active cloaking device.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you.
Because like every point in the movie, it only revealed itself when it was about to be harmed, destroyed, attacked, or when it was one-on-one with, or I guess one-on-four with the dogs. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's pretty resourceful doggos, man. Chewing through chain link fence to get out.
Yeah.
But that's the other thing. Like, sure. I don't fully understand whether what exactly spreads the infection.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, that's the way I think. What do you think of John Carpenter as a director? What are some of the aspects of his filmmaking you enjoy? I mean,
so I realized over the course of doing my research that I've seen very few John Carpenter movies. Actually, like, I've never seen the Escape From series. I think the only John Carpenter directed movies I've seen are Halloween, this, and Big Trouble in Little China. No, I've seen Ghost of Mars, but I thought that was trash. So I've really only seen like 3-4 of his movies, and a couple of the big ones I've missed.
So I've
like Carrie. I haven't seen freaking Carrie.
I haven't either. I've seen Escape, yeah, big. I've seen both the Escapes.
Okay,
I've seen the Big Trouble in Little China was a Carpenter movie, because mm-hmm. I know we did a Commission yeah. podcast on that. So that's a Carpenter film I haven't seen, and now I've seen this, and I've seen the first Halloween. I think that's all the Carpenter I've seen. So
okay,
I always admire a genre guy who goes full gonzo on the genre, but also you can tell has serious filmmaking chops.
Sure. Yeah.
Like, I think that's very, because a lot of times you get, you know, people that are excited about the schlocky aspects of it, but you can tell like they're weak on, you know, filming action, or, you know, really grounding a place in a set, or, you know, letting the camera pull back and impress you with a vista or a visual, or using it to like, I feel like John Carpenter is really good at atmosphere. He's good at efficient characterization, because even though these characters are kind of thin, they're very archetypal too. Mm-hmm. So you kind of like understand without too much in the way of you know, exposition who these guys are. Like, this guy is the sturdy older commander, and this guy is the kind of Han Solo bush pilot, and this guy is the, you know, studious doc. And I thought,
and that it works, stuff always worked. This yeah. isn't a character drama, right?
No.
I mean, this is a psychological battle between humans and aliens.
Right. In fact, it's probably helpful the more you can picture yourself in as Kurt Russell.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, and put yourself in that situation. So yeah, that's the thing. I'm not the world's foremost John Carpenter director, but like,
I love all of the stuff that I have seen of his. Yeah. I'm not one of those fans who's seen everything.
We should
just
watch
like
the Escape films. That would be a lot of fun.
Like, I bet that would. Yeah. Yeah.
Cause I think Escape from LA is kind of like, eh, but Escape from New York is the John Carpenter film. Right. And it's been probably 15 years since I've seen, in fact, I might've seen that one late in high school. I might have snuck that one in, because I know one of my buddies in art class was a huge John Carpenter fan.
Yeah.
And I wasn't for horror. So like, and there wasn't a, like, so I'm like, I think he put me up to seeing it, because I wanted to see this, but I didn't want anything that was scary because I couldn't handle it. Yeah. This thing I would have shit my pants if I'd seen this as a 16-year-old.
Yeah.
Anyway, where's Kurt Russell on the badass scale? Jim, what is the badass scale? Because we've been using Google Docs for the entire history of Bald Move, and yeah. I searched my Google Docs, and by God, I have the original badass spreadsheet rankings on Google Sheets.
Awesome.
Can you explain the...
So this, I don't remember the episode, but we used to do a show called Blue Yonder, where we dive into a topic each week, and one of them was badasses. And we actually did two of those episodes, Badasses and Badasses Part 2. And where we went and we took all of the badass movie stars and we ranked them on a three-factor scale.
The three C's.
The three C's, we called it. One is charisma, one is character, and one is champion. And those roughly translate to like how awesome and badass are the characters they play, mm-hmm. how much charisma do they have as actors, and how essentially much of a human champ, like how jacked are they?
Right.
You know, how intimidating are they physically?
Right.
And we gave everybody that we could think of a ranking.
It's a scale of 0 to 1, 1 being the epitome of the quality you're talking about.
Right. So max, you can get 3 points.
Yeah. So like there's only 2-3C badasses in our list, Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone.
Right.
And then you start, you know, people start losing points here and there. Cause the other thing is like, some of the characters can work against you. Like a guy, like for example, Kurt Russell has played a couple badasses, mm-hmm. you know, like Stargate, kind of a badass, Snake Plissken, total badass, MacReady, everyman badass, mm-hmm. but he's also played fucking Captain Ron. Like you lose badass points by clowning yourself.
Sure.
Like Schwarzenegger yeah. should probably lose more, but he's got... I mean, if a man's the Terminator, Conan the Barbarian, right. Dutch from Predator, you can be Kindergarten Cop, and no, yeah. you can birth to a live baby, right. and no one's going to say shit because you're a perfect 3 badass. So, I will say that I feel like maybe we're too low on Kurt Russell, because Kurt Russell right now is nestled between Christian Bale and Nathan Fillion.
What's his score?
He is the 32nd rank of badass on our list.
Does he have like a number score?
He's got a 0 for champion, which I think that's way too low. Okay. He's got a 0.75 for charisma, which is about right. But he's also got a 0.75 for character, which feels high to me. Like, but that's the thing, like... I would love to someday go through and revisit, like turn this into like a series,
a full podcast,
where we're like, we kind of like, Joanna Robinson, the Great Debates thing that she does at the Con of Thrones.
Yeah.
Like since everyone, you know, here's the list, it's published. Everyone make, arguments for additions to the list, and everyone makes particular arguments for like, this and this is this is a too low a rating because you've got this guy rated at 0.75 and this guy rated at 0 and this guy's at least as good as the point. Like, that's the kind of stuff I'd like to see.
Yeah. Also, I think you could turn that into a podcast series where you take one person each week.
Yeah.
You know, and you rank them. You go through their IMDb, scour it.
Yeah.
And you say, okay, what do they rank in the 3 C's? And right. you put them on the list.
The other glaring omission is we didn't do women.
Yeah,
and like right. now it's becoming more and more of a thing. Like, yeah. you know, like Scarlett Johansson would probably rank pretty high in the badass list.
We made a lot of damn mistakes in the early Blue Yonder podcast.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This
yeah.
is one of them.
Yeah. Carrie Fisher, I don't know if she'd make a badass, but Sigourney Weaver absolutely make the badass list.
Sure. Yeah. 100%. Friggin' John Connor's mom, whose name I can't think of at the moment.
Sarah Silverman.
Sarah
Connor. That's not a real name. Hamilton, Linda Hamilton.
Yes, thank you.
Absolutely, it'd be a badass. Yeah. So there's a lot we could go back and fix. I think that not be a bad idea.
Not a bad idea.
So we could do, once we got it established, we could do an annual rethinking. Like, right. who all had badass roles? Are we ready to let Ben Affleck into the club? Adrian Brody was in Predators. Like, can we get...
No. Sorry. He's forever barred.
It would
He's
be
the
funny.
One man who cannot make
See,
the
See, I think
it would
be funny to have, like, a negative badass scale. So, like, someone like, okay, you got cast as a badass. I can't argue that you were... I'm supposed to take you as a badass in Predator, but you have right. a -5 physical champion scale and a negative 0.75 charisma, so you congratulations, you're the first -1.25 badass. You were like,
you made the list.
If you and Schwarzenegger came together, you'd explode matter and antimatter.
Is there a perfect -3 badass?
Oh Jesus,
somebody who's been in a badass role
because the mere fact that they were cast as a badass would be like at least a 0.1 on the badass scale.
Would it though? Because we're only judging badasses. So like,
but I think that was one of the, we have to listen to the podcast, but I think that's one of our assertions that if a movie casts you as a badass, you have to accept the fact that they are a badass. Like you can quibble with the other C's, but a badass role is a badass role.
So you could only ever get a 0.25?
Like, for example, the guy who plays the wolf in Pulp Fiction.
Yeah. Harvey Keitel.
Harvey Keitel. He, like, even if Mr. Wolf was his only role, you could argue, and he's also charismatic, you argue he should belong somewhere on this list.
What if they get cast as a badass, but they completely fuck it up?
That's what I'm saying. Adrian Brody rule? Like, that's,
what if Pauly Shore was cast as the next main character in the Predator?
Well, you always have to have an exception to prove the rule.
Right.
Because, yeah. And then the other thing is the movie a comedy? Because, like, you know, you can't take Frank, what is it, Drubbins from the Naked Gun series. He's not a badass. It's a farce.
Right.
And like Predators is a farce.
All right. I feel like we talked too long on this, but watch for the future.
I'm actually kind of excited about a badass, resurrecting the badass scale.
I am too, yeah.
Bringing it into the 21st century. It was already in the 21st century, but really firmly into the 21st century.
Ideologically, yes.
Okay, let me get back to my notes. So there's your thing on the badass. Let's consider some trivia. Ennio Morricone scored this film, and he was nominated as worst original score at the Razzies that year.
The fuck?
Just shows you how things change. I feel this is now one of the highest regarded soundtracks of all time.
Oh, I don't know about that, but it's, I mean, that low, like, boom,
mm-hmm,
boom, that
mm-hmm,
kind of sound,
mm-hmm,
it really did it for me at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Really fucking just drove that film where it needed to be.
It's harsh and alien. And that's the thing, like, that's where this is something I was struggling to think of another counterpart, because it doesn't usually happen where something gets a Razzie, like seen as the worst, mm-hmm, and then a decade later is held up as an example of one of the best. I mean,
yeah,
like I can see things that were overlooked or were seen as kind of like, eh, and then we grew an appreciation for something like, this is a terrible movie. This is like 2.5 stars is pretty terrible in Ebert's book. Like, that's a movie I wouldn't, yeah, like, if he gives a 2.5 star, that's where, like, I'm like, well, I'm not even going to bother watching it then.
Hmm.
So, like, I feel like that's an amazing turnaround that this movie's had.
Yeah.
Number two, the U.S. camp, Norwegian camp, or one. Okay, you already told us that. This is John Carpenter's favorite film of his own. He self-identifies as the thing being his favorite film, and I can see why. It's really good. The dog thing, the one in the kennel, was created by Stan Winston, but he declined to be credited so as not to take away from Rob Bottin's amazing work.
Right.
Which, that's a pretty generous thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
According to Blair's calculations, it would take the thing exactly 3 years to infect the entire world, which seems slow. Like, I feel like once it made it off Antarctica and gets into, like, I don't know where they fly. They probably go from Antarctica to, like, I don't know where the hell you'd go. Because you can go, like, yeah, I guess you go up through South America if you're going to America.
Mm-hmm.
I know that the U.S. military wing, which is, I think, the Air National Guard of New York, is the one that resupplies them in the summer. And they actually operate out of the base, in New Zealand. For the summer season, and then they fuck off back to New York during the winter.
Okay.
Which is the summer in the Northern Hemisphere, of course. And that's it. That's all the trivia we got. Do you have any other closing comments you'd like to make on this film?
No, I don't think so.
All right. Well, Sean, thank you for commissioning another movie. I think you're going to get to double. I think you might get to double figures before we're done, because like 3 out of the next 4 are also Sean Ray joints.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for commissioning this podcast. I probably wouldn't have ever watched this film otherwise. I think I kind of want to mention it in terms of the spooktacular that Cecily and I are going to do in October, because it's a scary movie and she hasn't seen it either. So I'll make her watch it. Maybe watch the 2011. I kind of am very hot to watch the 2011 version just from the body horror angle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, see what modern special effects can do with the concept.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, thanks for asking us to watch this movie. Thanks for your commission. Thanks for your support of Bald Move. We'll be back with another commission podcast the next time. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See you later.